Hello, good evening, and welcome to Health Matters here on listener-supported Red River Radio. I am Dr. Randall Brewer, and I will be your host again this evening as we will get some more updates on COVID-19 from the standpoint of testing as well as research. Tonight we have a number of distinguished guests with us. We have Dr. Chris Kevel, Vice Chancellor for Research at LSU Health Sciences Center here in Shreveport, as well as Dr. Andrew Urochko, Professor of Microbiology and Immunology here at LSU Health in Shreveport, both joining us via Zoom, as well as Dr. Sean McNeil, psychiatrist here with the Overton Brooks Veterans Administration's Medical Center. And last but certainly not least, we welcome to Health Matters Dr. Sanford Katz, radiation oncologist with the Willis-Knighton Cancer Center. Welcome, everyone.
Good evening.
So let's go ahead and get right to, you know, right to the top of things. You know, Dr. Urochko, the president as well as the governor of our state are talking about opening the state up, so to speak, with regards to really the economy. Are we anywhere near that in our area? Could you give us an update in terms of, you know, the epidemiologists have one perspective on controlling this virus from the societal standpoint? They're in line with public health, but also people in economy circles have an idea about, you know, when things should open up, and then we have a political perspective. But from you as a basic science researcher and someone who's kept up with this epidemic very closely, what's your take on how we should approach opening up the state?
So obviously this is a question fraught and with many overtures, and there's many sides to it. From a standpoint of the virus, we're certainly on the flat part of the curve. If you can look at the data in Louisiana over the last month or so, and we certainly are seeing less cases, you know, per day. Certainly the ICUs have not been overwhelmed. And so I think in that context, we are on or where we want to be as a state going down. The question, as we see in the news, is when is the right time to open it up? And unfortunately, no one really knows in the sense that there are models. We know what will happen if it's done too early, but sadly or unfortunately, we won't know if it's done right until after the fact, in the context that if the numbers are really low and we can do contact tracing, we will be very successful. If the numbers turn out to be higher than anticipated, being a lot of these asymptomatic shedders are currently active in the community, when we bring people together again, we will see a more rapid flare up. And the answer to your question is we just don't know without sufficient testing. I think perhaps the study that came out, I think it was just today in New York, showing 14% of the New York citizens in the city were showing to be positive for the antibodies, at least to the virus. Now, is that meaning that 14% of the people were infected, or simply 14% out of X number, 20%, 30% show antibodies? So we don't really know at this point where we are. I think if everything's done correctly, we've seen the governor asked about continue wearing masks. I think if we practice social distancing, and potentially those who are worried about being infected, if we can, you know, be safe and careful, we can certainly mitigate what we're seeing. But, you know, I know it's a balance between multiple forces, and we have competing, you know, people pulling us in different directions. So I think that's where we are with the science of it, that we're going the correct direction. And I think as myself, as well as Dr. Kevel and everyone else, certainly hopes that that direction is what will continue as we open up.
You know, you mentioned we're on the flat part of the curve. So are we flat, or are we actually going down from a peak, so to speak?
it turns out that with a lot of these if we look at where there's a lot more evidence, you know, numbers are larger in Italy, Spain, where this has gone on, that flat part of the curve goes for a long time. You know, they have, when you see the models, you see these very nice little bell curves that go up, they go down, maybe you flatten it and it's all in an abstract setting, but knowing and seeing sort of this live data, you know, from these countries that have had it since February or somewhere in that time range, obviously slightly different in different countries, you can see it's really an extended curve. And there is absolutely a downside. So from the peak, but it's not a sharp drop. It's a long potential drop. And that's what concerns the epidemiologists, the virologists, the physicians, is that during that long drop, there are still active viral, you know, people shedding the virus, some recovered, some asymptomatic. And it all depends what that number is. You know, if it's 0.1% of the population, it's a lot harder to flare up quickly. If it's 1%, 5%, 10%, obviously a flare up is going to happen much, much quicker. And that's, at this point, is an unknown. And maybe that New York gives us the best example of what somewhere in that range of 5, 10, 15% might be infected.
This is Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. I'm your host tonight, Dr. Randall Brewer, and you can call and ask a question about our topic tonight, which is the COVID-19 epidemic and the current state in our region. The number for any questions or comments is 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet at RRR Public Radio. So Dr. Urochko mentioned, you know, the need for testing once we start to loosen the regulations or the guidelines with regards to social distancing. Dr. Kevel, I know with your experience with the Emerging Viral Threats Lab update, how are we with testing and how is the EVT done with regards to serving the community so far?
Yeah, so to follow up Dr. Urochko's comments and even talking a little bit about epidemiology, so I would say, and there's several pieces of data out there to suggest the number of new cases that we have that are being identified here in Louisiana are indeed actually going down. So there is a website called rt.live, which actually tracks an RT value, which is the reproduction of viral value. It's different from the R0, but it allows you to get a more real-time indication of the viral spread. And this is being done nationally using wide databases. And the bottom line with that is we are in a position where our RT level is less than one, which is good because that means we're not spreading the virus as other states are. So for example, in Nebraska, I know several people in Nebraska and they have several meat packing plants there that have had a rash of outbreaks, which has been problematic. So in that regard, we're quite fortunate. And in terms of testing, I don't know, many of the listeners may have seen an NPR article that came out yesterday that said that, you know, an ideal space would be where we have about a 10% positivity rate. And for us in the EV, 10% positivity, meaning that's the number of people of all that you test are positive for COVID-19. For the EVT lab now that we've actually done testing across the state, we've even done testing in the Baton Rouge area, North Louisiana, Northeast, Northwest. Our positivity rate is roughly 16%. And that aligns very well with the LDH data that is available on the website. So it clearly suggests that we're coming down, but as Dr. Urochko mentioned, we have to test. We have to increase our numbers of testing because that has to be robust in order for us to do the contact tracing once we identify an individual that's positive.
And from the standpoint of EVT, we say, you know, we've got this percentage that's positive. If people want to get more information about the EVT lab, how can they get in touch with you?
Yeah, so there is a website on the LSU Health webpage that's got the EVT lab. And
listeners can find all the information that they need there on that website. I don't have the URL in front of me at the moment, but it's there.
And in terms of the mobile testing that the Caddo Commission has recently approved, is the EVT lab working in concert with this commission?
Yes. So one of the things that's quite exciting is that the Caddo Parish Commission has been very supportive of the efforts at the EVT lab. And now we are working very closely with different community organizations where they're using, or rather they're letting us use access to their facilities, whether it's a parking lot or whether it's a general place for us to park the van that gets out into the community. So the Caddo Parish Commission has been fantastic. All the commissioners have been very supportive, and we look forward to really deploying testing across Caddo Parish and much to all of North Louisiana in a much more robust fashion.
You know, the governor recently, and we have Dr. Katz here, and we're going to have him weigh in on this topic as well. But from the standpoint of testing, the governor recently relaxed restrictions on elective medical procedures, and procedures that are deemed necessary are now permissible. And so from the standpoint of healthcare providers, are testing facilities going to be widely available to test patients who, let's say, before they come in and have a routine medical procedure, that they want to make sure that they're not bringing this virus into a healthcare facility? Or is that wide-scale use of testing going to be available here locally?
That question was for me. I don't know if Dr. Katz is there.
Yes, I'm here.
What's your take on that, Dr. Katz? Let's say you've got a patient that you're going to, you know, see and follow up for in your specialty. Have you had those discussions in your apartment? Should patients be tested before they come into the healthcare system, whether they're protecting themselves or the patients in the waiting room or the providers that are not necessarily on the front line,
right,
with maximal PPE?
Yeah, so the challenge in being an oncologist during this time is that, you know, we're dealing with a population that is very vulnerable, high risk to getting the infection, but at the same time still require treatment. The utility of doing testing on people before we saw them was not really very helpful, because the tests that were available were taking as much as 7 to 10 days, sometimes more. And even then, there were some issues sometimes with false negatives. And so that also didn't tell us anything about, you know, what might have happened in the interim from the time that they had their tests. So it just wasn't practical. You know, now that there are tests that are available that give a more rapid result, I think that that is something that may be considered in terms of testing people before procedures that would be, let's say, high risk to the staff, or perhaps might be, you know, high risk in terms of the environment, like the room or the procedure room in which they're being attended to. What we're doing in our cancer center is we are treating everybody like they are COVID-19 positive. And in that way, it, you know, without the benefit of knowing for certain, that creates the safest environment for everybody, not just the patients themselves, but our staff. And when I say that we assume everybody is positive, we assume that the staff is positive, that the patients are positive, and that family members and visitors are positive. And so what we've done is that we've really focused on minimizing the rate or the risk, rather, of contracting the virus while in the facility. So it starts off with limiting those people to the cancer center who have to be there. Obviously, the patient themselves, the staff, But in terms of visitors or family members that accompany the patients, unless it's absolutely necessary because the patient is either physically or mentally incapacitated, then we generally have the family member wait outside or in their car. Now, sometimes it's helpful to have a family member participate, let's say, in a consultation. So what we've been doing is getting people on the phone. So our first order of business was really keeping everybody safe. Some other things that we've done is to separate out patients both physically and temporally in terms of the times that they're treated so that we don't have people in the waiting rooms congregating. So there's typically one person in a waiting area at a particular time. Then they come in and get their treatment, and then we have a designated person who goes and cleans their entire area where that person was. And then in the treatment rooms where people are receiving radiation, they're actually cleaning down the entire area. We have had some patients who we've known to be COVID-19 positive, though, you know, they weren't necessarily symptomatic, but we screen them when they come in the door. Everybody gets their temperature taken, gets a history of exposure, previous testing and whatnot. So we have had some folks who we've known to be positive. And so we've taken extra special precautions with them where we treat them at the very end of the day, have them come in through a separate entrance, things of that sort. So in terms of testing people before they come in, you know, that's something that I think that would allow us to relax some of these procedures. But I think, you know, I don't think it would necessarily change what we're doing. Now, for treatments that would cause immunosuppression, let's say chemotherapy, that's a situation where if somebody was COVID-19 positive and then you gave them immunosuppressive medications, that obviously could make matters worse. So I do think that there is a role for testing people, certainly in the oncologic setting and also with respect to some of the from the surgical procedures. I don't want to run too long and talk about, you know, every aspect of medicine, but, you know, I treat a lot of head and neck cancer, and I know that some of the surgical procedures that my ENT colleagues do, they're up in the nasal cavity, and that's where the virus tends to live. And so the procedures that they do can aerosolize the virus and really cause a contamination of the room. And we still don't really know necessarily how long it can linger in the air. We don't know enough about it that we can be 100% certain as to, what the risks are in doing that procedure, even with full PPEs. I do worry about those procedures. And I think if there was a measure of certainty that, you know, with some testing that those patients were not coronavirus positive, that there could be a little bit more comfort in doing some of the procedures that right now are being postponed just out of concern.
Yeah, it's quite reminiscent of the early days of the HIV epidemic where, you know, I think that was the original term universal precautions really sort of developed. You know, you have to assume you have it and everyone else has it as well to maintain maximal safety. This is Health Matters on listener-supported Red River Radio. You can call us with a question or comment about our topic tonight, COVID-19. The number is 1-800-552-8502, or you can tweet at RRR Public Radio. Dr. Sean McNeil, thank you for joining us this evening. Over there at the VA, you know, they have a unique situation with regards to their, you know, where their health care is received, things along those lines. I know there have been some modifications made at RVA. Summarize for us, if you will, you know, how has this epidemic affected our veteran population here locally?
Well, I can speak specifically to mental health patients because that's my specialty. Of course, this pandemic has brought on more stress for everybody. And sometimes that can indicate it can cause higher levels of depression, higher levels of anxiety. So I think that we're trying to be as proactive as possible. And one way that the VA has sought to do that is to roll out telehealth. Telehealth is something that the VA has been championing for a while, far ahead of this COVID crisis. In fact, I've been at the VA for 2 years now, and they've been rolling out telehealth for that, the duration of that 2 years. And specifically in the mental health service, we were actually all required to have our first video call with a patient by, I think it was July of last year. So they were anticipating that this technology was going to be a useful means for treating patients, but I don't think anyone could have necessarily predicted this pandemic and how important the technology has become.
You know, I can imagine, you know, being a, you know, a practitioner that maybe isn't fully on board with electronic medicine, so to speak, you know, still utilizing a paper chart, maybe out in a rural area, you know, how quickly can providers get telehealth ramped up? It seems like it can be a, you know, a very difficult thing to do, especially with patient populations that may have intermittent access to the internet, maybe not have the most advanced cellular technology. So how do you guys do it there at the VA?
Well, the VA has their own, I guess we call it a proprietary video conferencing software. Actually, if you're on an Android device, now you can be on any device with the camera and it should work. But any type of Android device, you just open the link that's sent to you in your email. If you're on an iPhone, you do have to download the VA Video Connect app. And so, yeah, part of the response to this crisis is reaching out to these patients ahead of their scheduled appointment times and trying to make sure that they know the ins and the outs of using telehealth and trying to get them set up so that the calls are as smooth as possible.
You know, my understanding is, you know, the mental health population, you know, compliance with visits, you know, showing up to visits and things along those lines, navigating the healthcare system to actually get in front of the provider. Do you find that telehealth accommodates patients in that regard, in terms of enabling visits to actually occur that may otherwise be challenging for patients, especially patients with certain conditions? You know, PTSD comes to mind, agoraphobia mm-hmm. comes to mind, things along those lines.
Yeah, correct. I have quite a number of patients. They're preferring the video calls. I have some immunocompromised patients that are very nervous about the prospect of getting COVID. But yes, and then the PTSD clinic, this is a patient population that has a tendency to isolate themselves anyways. Now, I've heard it both ways from patients. Some of the patients are actually happy about the prospect of not having to go out in public and interact with crowds. And then there's the flip side. There are some people who are more isolated, and that isolation can cause depression. So I think all of that is essential to bear in mind.
With PTSD, do you find that social distancing is more difficult in that situation?
So the majority of my veterans are Vietnam era veterans, and I would say most of them are doing fine with the social distancing. Now, it's unfamiliar territory for everybody. Even the older veterans say they've never seen anything like this before. So I do think, you know, there's some trepidation, but in general, I don't think they're having a problem with the distancing.
Excellent. You know, Dr. Kevel, if we could, you know, go back into the testing aspect a little bit more. You know, a number of excellent points were raised about testing for positive viral results. And we've also learned here recently from Dr. Ghali that serologic testing is going to be available here locally. If you can, and Dr. Katz mentioned, you know, a test that might take a week to come back and then a test that might take, you know, less than an hour to come back. If you will, what's the difference between the quick test and maybe the longer test for the virus? And what is the purpose of serologic testing?
Right. So to answer the first question regarding the different time periods, really what that was, the reason why it was taking a week to come back was because a lot of different labs simply weren't prepared. And so depending upon what the lab was running, whether they were using what we call a big automated machine that has a sample test kits that are required. They're what we call them box kits. Those were back ordered for a lot of clinical laboratories. The EBT lab is very different. It utilizes still technology called PCR, which stands for polymerase chain reaction. And that test is a gold standard. And at the EBT lab, provided the specimen comes to us forever for it to get here. So in other words, if it doesn't come from a rural area or too far away, that test can be turned around. Now our average turnaround time is 1.07 days. So essentially 24, 25 hours. In the past, there was issues in that regard. But as Dr. Katz was mentioning, there are new testing and new technologies that have come out. Some of them, there's a company called Abbott that has a technology that the president has showcased during his press conference. It's called ID Now, which is essentially roughly a 5 to 15 minute test, depending upon whether the person has the virus or not. If the person has the virus, the test is completed rather quickly in a matter of 5 to maybe 6 or 7 minutes. If the person doesn't have the virus, the test may take up to 15 minutes to run to confirm that there isn't the presence of the virus. It doesn't utilize PCR. It uses other molecular biology techniques. And there are a whole host of other tests that are out there. Really, what is nice now is that there are different testing modalities for the virus that a lot of labs can now use, which is good, because depending upon whether you really want to test a patient before they go and have a surgical procedure, or whether you want to quickly determine whether a patient has COVID because they're critically ill in the emergency department, there are ways to do that now. And the key at the end of the day to keep this virus under check once it really starts to go down is to continue to do the viral testing. Now, you mentioned a moment ago the concept of testing for serology, which otherwise known as antibodies, which is an immune response that your body mounts to the virus. And so there are several different ways to do this out there. In fact, over the past weekend, there were articles in both the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal that highlighted the fact that this is the Wild West, because there are many tests that are out there that have an accuracy, some as low as only 20%. So in other words, doing that kind of test is actually harmful because it gives people a false sense of security. Here at LSU, what we've done in conjunction with the immunology group and the virology group is utilized a testing technique through a collaboration with Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai in New York that has already received FDA emergency use authorization. That is a two-step, what's called ELISA test. So I won't get into a lot of the science other than to say it utilizes chemicals and proteins that are very specific to the SARS-CoV-2 virus. As Andrew, I'm sure, can attest, we've all been exposed to many different coronaviruses that really haven't had much of an effect in terms of causing sickness. And sometimes you can get cross-reactivity or what we would call non-specific reactions to some of these coronaviruses because their proteins may be similar to one another. The test that we're doing is actually highly specific and highly sensitive for detection of the SARS-CoV-2 virus. Right now, there are only four antibody tests that are approved through the FDA emergency use authorization. So before an individual goes and gets a test, one of the things to think about and to even ask perhaps is that test that they're about to be, taking, has it been approved by the FDA? And that way they know to some degree that the test will give them a reasonable sense of whether they've mounted an immune response.
So that, brings up a number of questions with regards to Dr. Urochko, the serologic testing. Do we know yet whether the antibodies that are formed in the response to the SARS coronavirus type 2 are protective against a future infection? That's, I guess, a
So that it remains an open question. So theoretically, there's no reason they can't be. There is absolutely protection in the two normal benign coronaviruses that cause, you know, some roughly 20-25% of the common cold. You do get antibodies, and there is neutralization capabilities in those antibodies. They also showed that with the SARS coronavirus 1 and MERS. The question comes down to whether it's going to follow some of the same patterns and be protective, and there's probably going to be some yeses and some noes. We've done some testing at our lab, at the EVT lab, looking at patients who have recovered. Some are very high antibody titers, some are very low antibody titers. And this, again, is common with what we know about the other coronaviruses. Some generate a very nice immune response, some do not. We do know with this current coronavirus that some of the sicker patients do generate a better response than some who are asymptomatic shedders. So that in itself can be a problem. The people that seem to get it, cause no disease, run around shedding virus to everyone else, may not actually have a long-lasting immunity and therefore may be susceptible to infection over and over again. And unfortunately, it remains an unanswered question. But like I said, theoretically, there's no reason it can't be protective for at least a set amount of time, whether it be weeks to a few months or maybe even a few years.
So how does that portend the success rate of any potential, vaccines that are developed?
So when you think of a vaccine, if it follows normal paradigms, being if it mimicked exactly the immune response, the potential vaccine would be something that would only have, short-term potential. However, when you think of vaccines, these vaccines through the use of adjuvants, which essentially help the vaccine and allow it to target different points within the immune response, can really bring things out that the normal virus may not. So in theory, the adjuvant and the correct adjuvant along with the correct vaccine target, obviously there's 100 and some vaccines or somewhere around that number currently being looked at. The hope would be it would have a lasting effect more than just a few months. But even our normal flu vaccine you get every year, obviously I realize it's different with the flu changing that, and you need it. But again, if that's what we would have to do, have it every year, maybe with our flu vaccine, that's what we have to do. I guess to summarize, there's no reason a vaccine should not work to the coronavirus, and there's no reason we can't get a vaccine. The question, of course, is will we get one as quickly as everyone hopes?
Yeah, I read an article recently in the veterinary space. Apparently, they've been trying for a number of years to develop a vaccination to protect certain animal species. Is a coronavirus vaccine a relatively straightforward, particle to develop an effective vaccine against? Or this one in particular, do we know?
The answer is no, we don't really know, because, up until SARS, the first SARS coronavirus came out, MERS, and now the second one, there was no reason or any money to really put forth a coronavirus vaccine that's caused the common cold. When SARS, the first coronavirus, came out in the 2002 range, at the time, vaccine technology was a lot different than it is now. And they were starting to develop aspects of vaccine. There were some problems. Again, when that went away after a few years, there was no reason to follow up on that. So you're right that there hasn't been a coronavirus vaccine created yet because they haven't had a need to. But theoretically, there's no reason that you can't generate a vaccine. Now, it turns out the spike protein, which is the if you look at the pictures of a coronavirus, how it got its name with the little corona around the virus when it was first seen in the EM, that those spikes that give it the corona are what the antibodies and are what the vaccine would be targeted. And there's no intellectual reason or scientific reason you can't generate one. The question is, will it work the way we hope it will?
And I know you don't do, epidemiology and vaccine trials, but, if we're going to develop herd immunity, and obviously the coronaviruses that we've all been exposed to have not produced herd immunity that cross-reacts with this particular virus, at least in many people, I understand vaccine trials can undergo a number of different designs where you give the vaccine and let people have natural exposure versus more of a concentrated trial where you actually intentionally exposed individuals to, you know, viral particles. What's your take on, you know, how aggressive should we actually be in getting something out there, which, you know, we don't know if natural immunity is protective?
So, you know, again, there's a lot of ifs in this. I can't imagine ethically they could give someone a vaccine and expose them to a virus that, if our numbers are somewhere in the ballpark of 1-ish to greater percent, you know, case fatality rate, that would be a very risky venture. So I think what the goal would be would be to give people, you know, the vaccine. Obviously, some would get it, some would not, and then we would follow them in a normal routine. Would people who were vaccinated have a lesser chance of coming down with the virus or less disease versus someone without? And this would be the same idea with, you know, obviously dealing with an Ebola vaccine or any other dangerous virus. You simply hope you get good antibodies. You put those people, are, you know, you do the people living on a day-to-day and they're in an environment where they could be exposed, and you chart them or follow them over time.
Yeah, it seems like a daunting task because obviously everything that we're doing now is to limit the exposure to the virus, right?
Correct.
But to develop a vaccine, we actually need people exposed to the virus.
It is. It's a catch-22, right? Stay away from the virus to avoid getting infected or, you know, get a vaccine. But I think as people go back to work, and, you know, the other idea would be if, again, in theory, if the vaccine, we'll just say pick date X, that it became ready and there was a flare up of the virus, they could vaccinate the people in that hot spot, and you would then look, does that hot spot and all the seronegative people at that time do, if none of them show evidence of infection, you would have, you know, strong scientific and medical data that in fact those folks that were vaccinated didn't come down with the virus, where, you know, those in the community that first the hotspot developed did, and you would, you know, consider that as an element of success of the vaccine. And this is unfortunately what will have to be done with this virus. And a good example, which I think you're hinting at, is what happened with Zika. When there was a big flare-up, they wanted to get a vaccine, they wanted to test it. By the time they wanted to test it, the virus was largely at a low level, and they never could really test the efficacy of that particular vaccine.
Yeah, I mean, it almost, yeah, becomes a moving target. And obviously there are a lot of commercial interests involved. If you, you know, develop large scale production for something that you don't need, that's a large investment. So it sounds like there's a lot to be worked out. A question that's coming in for this particular topic is that, are RNA vaccines safe? And maybe you could back up a step and let us know, you know, what RNA means to this particular virus, ribonucleic acid. Yeah.
Sure. So the answer to the first part is yes, it is safe. There's no evidence, and they've already been putting it into people. And I'll cover the second part in just a minute. So they've already been testing one of the prime potential vaccine candidates, which is an RNA vaccine. They put it into several people. And in fact, it was just in the news, I think it was yesterday, that a couple of them are getting their second dose to the vaccine. So what it means when you have an RNA vaccine, if you think of the classic vaccine, was you take a virus, you grow it under funny conditions, high temperature, low temperature, and different cells than it's supposed to be grown in. And then you either heat kill it or you give it live, but very weak. And you stick that sort of particle into somebody, and that's your classic vaccine. The second sort of main one, which exemplified hepatitis B, they take the parts of the virus, you know, apart, and they just vaccinate you to, you know, specific proteins. For an RNA vaccine, like you said, ribonucleic acid, they take the actual coding RNA from the virus just for the spike protein or any protein they might want. They inject that RNA into the person, again, obviously with the appropriate buffers to get the vaccine to work. And then they let the host, the person being vaccinated, make the viral protein. That protein is then recognized as foreign, and then the immune response targets, say, the spike protein, or again, any other protein that you might want to target. And so the idea and the reason they went that way was, as soon as they had the virus genome sequence in China, they could send it to the CDC. They could then start taking that, I mean, within really days to weeks, they had a, you know, the target RNA, and they could start designing that for a vaccine. So it was really as rapid and as new and exciting an idea, and something that could be done very, very quickly and in this time of need.
Very interesting information. This is listener-supported Red River Radio. I'm your host for Health Matters tonight. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer. Our topic tonight is the COVID-19 epidemic, and we are updating information both locally as well as regionally. Our guests tonight include Dr. Chris Keppel, Vice Chancellor for Research here at LSU Health in Shreveport, Dr. Andrew Urochko, Professor of Microbiology Immunology, also here at LSU Health in Shreveport, and Dr. Sean McNeil, Department of Psychiatry here at the Overton Brooks VA Medical Center, and Dr. Sanford Katz, radiation oncologist with the Willis Knighton Cancer Center. Dr. Katz, I believe you had a question for one of our guests with regards to herd immunity. Go ahead and ask your question now that I have you on the line.
Yeah, this is for Dr. Urochko. So if I understand what you're saying about the test to determine whether you've had exposure and developed some immunity, from what I understand, you said that it just because you have evidence of exposure and perhaps some degree of immunity, that doesn't necessarily confer long-term protection from reinfection of the virus. Is that correct?
That is correct.
So if that's the case, then what's the utility of that serology test if it doesn't give you information that you can then act on in terms of, let's say, decrease your need for PPE, or perhaps enable you to feel safer to do higher risk exposures, or for that matter to travel around the community, then it sounds like, I think you alluded to, a false sense of security.
Well, so let me just clarify that having the antibody, you know, means you've been exposed to the virus. And from a scientific standpoint, that's the strong statement we can make. But we absolutely know that from the other two benign coronaviruses, you do get a short-term immunity, and you don't seem to get, say, either of those two over and over again in the same year. And so I don't think we can yet say that somebody who is tested has a high antibody titer, that they are not protected. We just don't know how long that will be, and in all cases, if that's protected. The assumption is, based on the other coronaviruses, that if you have a high titer antibody, and we're going to test some of the, in our EVT lab, we're doing neutralization assays now, which will hopefully clarify some of that, that you would have at least short-term protection from the virus. And again, like I said, that's backed up by evidence with the other viruses. What we don't know, whether everyone who's been exposed will generate a response, and will everyone's antibody responses be the same. So I agree with you. These are cautions that Dr. Keppel, myself, Dr. Sapp, who's chair of Micro, that we've been discussing with the Louisiana Department of Health, in that we want to be very, very careful what it means, what we can state. And I think we're just being cautious in that comment. And your points are well taken. They're the same things that we've articulated. But in summary, it does not mean that you're not protected. What we can't yet say is, in all cases, will they be protected?
Okay,
and
thank
that's
you.
Sort of and, ongoing work.
And just a follow-up to that. So is it reasonable to assume that if you do demonstrate the antibody, that if you did get reinfected, let's say in the fall or perhaps early next year, that one could expect to have a more mild course of the illness if you in fact did become symptomatic?
And that's the assumption, and that is sort of backed up by some of the data that exists, that there seemed to be some cross-reactivity between people who had either OC43 or HKU1, which are the other two benign coronaviruses that are in the same family as this particular SARS. They do show in some of the antibody tests some cross-reactivity, which would suggest that those antibodies are in fact binding to viral particles. So your idea is exactly right, that if you were tested, you were seropositive, a good antibody response, that you should either A, be less susceptible to an infection, or at least maybe require a higher dose, or you would have less symptoms. And that's the idea. The question then is, how long does it last, from weeks to say 40 weeks to possibly a couple years? And that's really, again, unknown questions.
Okay, and one last follow-up question on that. So would that necessarily mean that you couldn't spread the virus, or does it increase your likelihood of perhaps being an asymptomatic carrier if you got reinfected?
Yeah, I don't think there's anyone knows. I mean, as you know, in a classical sense, you have antibodies to a virus that prevents you from getting infected. You get your flu vaccine, you have antibodies, you in theory don't get infected, or if it's very, very mild. Presumably, if it's the former, you don't get infected, you would not be a shedder. If it's the latter, that you're you have low symptoms, or maybe you would be more severely afflicted based on whatever risk factor, but you have a high antibody titer and you have a very low symptoms. At that point, if you have symptoms, you're very likely shedding virus. And that's sort of evidenced by, you know, the windows when they know from, people shed virus, at least the ones they can test being symptomatic, which, you know, you're in a more controlled setting. So I think all those are very interesting points and things we're still learning more about these viruses.
Do we, Dr. Urochko, do we have any idea what the situation is with people testing positive for the virus after they've cleared the infection, after they've been to the hospital, gotten out, and they self-quarantine? I think there are even some, you know, news people on TV say, you know, they're going to continue to stay in their basement until they test negative for the virus, even though they've cleared the infection, no longer having fever. I mean, this virus seems to be hyper-efficient when it comes to its ability to shed.
So it does. I think there's a couple different questions there. From the standpoint of being testing seronegative, and there were a couple studies released from other countries in the world that they said that they were negative and then they showed positive. Dr. Kevel, myself, and Dr. Bana at the school, we actually have an article, I think, coming out addressing a little bit of that. And briefly, from a virological sense, there's three possibilities. One is a reactivation of a dormant virus. There's no evidence that this virus has a classic latency like HIV or the herpes viruses. It certainly could have been a new infection. We can't rule that out. But I think very likely, which you said exactly the point, that some people might be potentially long-term shedders, and they're probably shedding at a very low level near the limit of detection. And if you think about it, on day one, you're below limit of detection. Day two, you're slightly above it. You would test positive. Day three, you might be low. And there's certainly evidence of people shedding virus at or around this limit of detection, being sort of negative, positive, negative, positive. So I think that to me would be the most likely scenario, but you certainly can't rule out that they didn't get a reinfection. And I know there's some evidence with some of these asymptomatic shedders that probably had a very quick infection, that they, a lot of them, at least the first reports I've read, didn't seem to have did not seem to generate a strong antibody response. So again, in theory, if it was something like that, they could have had the virus, no antibody response, and be reinfected at a subsequent, not that long after. But again, that's just some theory based on that.
I mean, just to get a little cellular, how is it that a virus can enter, you know, reproduce itself and shed without an individual really getting very sick?
Well, you know, again, a lot of viruses are very good at this. If you look at all these viruses across the spectrum, you know, in an ideal world, a virus that causes little or no disease and sheds very effectively have hit the home run, because no one's going to spend money to get rid of them. There's no evolutionary pressure. So really, for this particular virus to hit the evolutionary home run would be like its sort of cousins, the OC43 and HKU1, the two benign ones that come seasonally. No one cares about them. You get a little common cold. They come, they go, they never disappear. No one cares about them. And that would sort of be, you know, the real, again, from a virus standpoint, a home run. So they're very, very good at that. And in theory, that's what it wants to do. And again, why you have this weird mix of asymptomatic shedders that are just running around perfectly healthy versus those that, you know, have a really, really negative and very sad outcome is remains, you know, unfortunately an unknown.
Yeah, isn't it the H1N1 that caused the epidemic in 1918 actually the same virus that is still circulating around that has become, you know, smarter, if you will, and not wiping out villages to where it can't move on, you know, across the globe, right?
Correct. The Spanish flu that went from 1918 to 1920 or thereabouts was an H1N1.
Dr. McNeil, from your experience, you know, how does this affect the veteran population? Are they asking you a lot of questions about, you know, these very topics? You know, when is a vaccine going to be available? If I get sick, are there going to be effective treatments available? What are you hearing over there from the vets when it comes to, you know, what comes next? Those that, you know, want to get out, want to ease the social distancing, want to move on.
Right. There is a lot of, it's on people's minds, you know, when is it going to be safe to move on to normal life? Just to answer the first question. We do get a lot of, patients who are, who wonder about vaccination. They wonder about getting their labs done during a crisis, getting tested. I think the VA has responded to that, and you know, they have drive-through testing, which if the patients are interested in that, they can call their primary care clinic and get that set up. There's also a drive-up pharmacy now, so we're trying to minimize as much face-to-face contact as possible. So we actually have tents set up in our parking lot. Patients who really need to pick up their medicines can pull up to those tents, and the pharmacist can help them. I haven't fielded too many specific questions about the vaccine in particular. I do think they probably reserve those questions for their primary care physicians.
You know, Dr. Kevel, you know, we're not at the point of having a vaccine. We've, you know, talked a lot about that, and it'd be great if we could get that, you know, sooner rather than later. It sounds like it may be a little bit of a challenge to get one developed. Update us, if you will, with regards to some of the things we talked about last time. In terms of treatment, I understand there's a nitric oxide trial. There was a VA study, actually, Dr. McNeil, that was published with regards to hydroxychloroquine for infections. We've got convalescent plasma out there, mention of hyperimmune sera in development. Dr. Kevel, update us on how we're actually treating symptomatic infections now.
Yeah, so, you know, since the last time we spoke, we really moved forward with a lot of advanced clinical trials, and several people that I've talked to and that have known me have said, why have you been so frenetic in your pace of getting everything lifted and moving forward? And part of it was because the most precious thing in a time like this is time, and we don't have any real treatment. And fortunately for us at LSU Health Shreveport, we have some of the best intensive care physician specialists, and I'm not saying that because I know them. I'm saying that because their performance and their numbers are just incredible in terms of the way that they can take care of patients. But really, the key was to bring on board really smart clinical trials that would potentially help us provide care to the individuals who are most susceptible to the disease. So the inhaled NO trial continues to move forward. In fact, we had a call with Harvard at the earlier part of this week, and it's looking so far there's an interim result that's being tabulated at the moment to make sure that the safety is good. But from Dr. Keith Scott and Dr. Steve Conrad, who are leading this, have both commented, and I think they've been interviewed recently, that it does help the patient's ability to oxygenate. So in other words, they're able to get more oxygen to their tissues, which is one of the biggest limitations initially of this disease. Secondly, the convalescent plasma therapy has been really strong and good. We've had a great collaboration with LifeShare and their team, and patients who have received the convalescent therapy have gone on most times to do better and to improve. And as Dr. Rajko was mentioning earlier about the antibodies, the whole point of convalescent plasma therapy is a patient that goes home to get better or is discharged from the hospital is what we call convalescing, and they've mounted an immune response. And so the way that you can transfer this, it's almost like a passive immunity, because you can take plasma from that individual, provided that it's compatible with the recipient, and you can give it to them. And then those antibodies can be useful in the individual who's critically ill. So that's a really good thing, and that looks to be promising thus far. And by the way, that's been used in other infectious outbreaks to significant success. But that's not where we're stopping. We're actually doing now beginning new clinical trials very soon, within the next week, that will utilize a drug that goes and cleaves, or specifically cuts off what are called glycosaminoglycans. They're essentially sugars on the surface of a cell. Why that is important is because that's part of the way that the virus uses to bind to the surface of a cell so it can actually infect the cell, so it can get in. And in fact, this company that we're going to do the trial with had actually done a small trial at the end of the Wuhan epidemic. And so we've been working very closely with them, and we'll be one of the few sites in the nation that will be able to provide this kind of trial and this kind of therapy. So we're really excited about that. And then lastly, many people may have heard in the media, perhaps, or certainly in the scientific literature, the concept of a massive immune response called the cytokine storm. And so to deal with what the cytokine storm is, there's a lot of different interventions that are currently on the market to handle chronic inflammatory disease states, whether it's arthritis or whether it's inflammatory bowel disease or other kinds of inflammation. And we're trying to target these things called cytokines. So that's coming down the pike. So I'm proud to say that our staff and faculty have done a fantastic job of bringing to the forefront a lot of advanced clinical interventions that are smart. Because the one thing that we really want to do is we want to make smart decisions to try to help these patients at a time where literally we are learning things as we go.
Well, Dr. Kevel, thank you so much. That was an excellent review of what's going on with regards to treatment of the COVID-19 disease. Also, thanks to Dr. Andrew Yarochko, professor of microbiology and immunology here at LSU in Shreveport. Thanks to Dr. Sean McNeil, psychiatry here at Overton Brooks VA Medical Center. And also thanks to the wonderful Dr. Sanford Katz, radiation oncologist with the Willis-Knighton Cancer Center. You'll be able to find out more information on COVID-19 at coronavirus.gov. This program will be available for podcast at www.redriverradio.org. And you can also find COVID-19 updates for Arkansas, Louisiana, and Texas on the Red River Radio homepage. Health Matters is a production of Red River Radio. The producer is Renee Moran. Thanks tonight to Mr. Kermit Poling and Mr. Wally Derleth for providing production assistance. Views and opinions expressed on Health Matters tonight may not reflect those of Red River Radio, LSUS, or its staff. Health Matters has been made possible in part by the Noel Foundation, as well as the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. This is 89.9 FM KDAQ Shreveport Bossier City, 90.7 FM KLSA Alexandria Pineville, 90.9 FM KBSA El Dorado Camden Magnolia, 88.9 FM KLDN Lufkin Nacogdoches, and 100.7 FM KTYK Overton, Tyler Kilgore. I'm Dr. Randall Brewer, and thank you so much for joining us this evening.
I dream that my soul rose unexpectedly.